From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the fight over the unconstitutional funding of public schools in Texas continues, even after the legislature restored many of the deep funding cuts.
Why should the kids in Irving be penalized merely because of their zip code? And that's really what it amounts to.
Should we call him Johnny Football or Johnny Cash? The scandal surrounding the Texas A&M star quarterback Johnny Manziel.
He's either the villain of our times or the hero that we've been waiting for, depending on your perspective.
And 200 years ago this weekend was the Battle of Medina, a bloodbath in Texas history frequently overlooked.
And the Battle of Medina was the biggest, bloodiest battle ever fought in Texas, west of the Mississippi.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Texas school districts will begin this year with big differences in state funding. That's one of the reasons a judge in February found the Texas school finance system unconstitutional for the second time in a decade. KERA's Shelley Koffler takes a look at the funding gap and how it's affecting kids in a district that's often at the end of the receiving line.
When school opens this month, the Irving District expects all of its elementary classes to be filled to capacity. That's where they were when school dismissed in May. And we visited the classroom of kindergarten teacher Cheryl Dennehy.
Some days you feel like, you know, you're running from emotional needs to physical needs to the educational needs.
Dennehy began last school year with 35 active little kindergartners in her room. That's way over the state limit of 22. She eventually got relief. Irving hired additional teachers. But at the end of the year, staffing was still so stretched, every elementary class was at the limit or had to get permission from the state to include more students than are normally allowed. Dennehy says many of her children needed more individual attention than she was able to give.
Some of these kids have never been in school before, and they walk into a big school, and it's big people, and they're just so unsure of themselves. And sometimes I wish I could give them a little bit more time to deal with some of those emotional needs.
Irving is a district that's used to doing more with less. 2 years ago, it received just over $5,000 in funding per student, the smallest amount among 14 districts in Dallas County. That was 24% less than Coppell received, 30% less than Highland Park. So much less that Irving became Exhibit A for attorney Rick Gray, as he helped convince a judge to rule that the Texas school funding system is unconstitutional because it's inequitable.
Why should the kids in Irving be penalized merely because of their zip code? And that's really what it amounts to. It's all of our kids, we're all state citizens, and everybody needs to be given the same educational opportunity, in my opinion.
Gray says districts receive wildly different amounts of funding because Texas primarily pays for public education with local property taxes. A concept known as Robin Hood requires property wealthy districts to give some of their tax money to poorer districts. Still, those with higher property values raise more money for their schools, simple as that.
I need to hear you go five.
And here's how that affects a district like Irving. Although it's received numerous awards for being efficient with the tax dollars it does have, less funding has led to painful penny pinching. A computer shortage means some classrooms have to do without when statewide exams are given. Labs have been turned into classrooms because schools are running out of space. Field trips for many have been cut to one a year. Teacher workload has increased with the elimination of assistant principal jobs. During an interview before he resigned, Superintendent Dana Bedden said the state's funding system has shortchanged Irving children.
Why wouldn't all children be worth the same allocation of resources? Something's fundamentally wrong with that. Maybe their children could have been performing at a higher level had we had all the resources.
Attorney Rick Gray agrees. He analyzed the state's 1,000-plus districts and found a correlation between funding and learning.
We looked at SAT scores, ACT scores, dropout rates, tax scores, which was the standardized test at the time. In every single instance, over a 6 or 7 year period, those groups of districts that had more did better. And they did better on every single indicator. You know, it was just striking to me to see that.
Faced with the judge's finding that the school funding system is unconstitutional, legislators this year restored more than half of the $5.4 billion school dollars they cut 2 years ago. Representative Diane Patrick, an Arlington Republican on the Appropriations Committee, says the additional money will be spent in a way that most helps districts like Irving.
The funds that will be distributed in the basic allotment, which does take into consideration property wealth. And so you will see the more property poor districts receiving more of that in the distributions.
But did lawmakers do enough to convince Judge John Dietz to reverse his ruling when he reviews it in January? Neither Patrick, the governor, lieutenant governor, nor the attorney general would defend the system or venture a prediction. KERA's analysis of state numbers shows districts this year will receive an average of 4% more money. Irving and some of the lowest funded districts will receive slightly more than that, but the gap between the lowest and highest funded districts has closed only slightly. In Dallas County, for example, Richardson has replaced Irving as the district receiving the smallest per pupil funding, $979 less than Highland Park, which will receive the most. That means a classroom in Highland Park with 22 kids will have more than $21,000 additional dollars for its children. And the gap between schools statewide is even bigger.
The state said that there may be a crisis looming, but it's not yet here. And we simply said, no, we have a crisis right now.
Attorney Gray says legislators have only put a Band-Aid on the problem when major surgery is what's needed. Shelley Koffler, KERA News.
Everyone is talking about Johnny Manziel, the Texas A&M star quarterback and the first freshman to win the Heisman. Manziel is accused of violating strict college football rules against players profiting from the game. The Manziel story is no longer just a sports story. It's a reflection of Texas and the state's values. Johnny Football, as Manziel is frequently called, is featured on the new cover of Texas Monthly. Texas Monthly editor-in-chief Jake Silverstein explains why this is such a big story.
Johnny Football, for your listeners who aren't college football fans or who, you know, haven't turned on the television in the last couple of weeks, is quarterback at Texas A&M, who the first freshman to ever win the Heisman Trophy, won the Heisman Trophy last fall after a pretty spectacular season. So Manziel won the Heisman last year and is coming back this year to for his second season playing quarterback for the team. Although there's now some question as of a couple weeks ago about whether or not he'll play, and that's because he is reported to be under investigation by the NCAA for signing autographs for money in the off-season. College football players are required to be amateurs, meaning they can't take any money for any form of compensation for anything that they do on or off the football field. And Manziel is, as I say, reportedly being investigated by the NCAA for doing that. And if he's found guilty of that, he could be ineligible to play, which would be huge deal, big news, and somewhat catastrophic. Although it should be noted that, you know, it's often very difficult for the NCAA to prove these things, and Manziel, whose family has quite a bit of money, has already lawyered up severely.
I don't know if you remember this or not, but the last time we were talking about the Lance Armstrong on the cover for the Bob Steer Awards, and Manziel had just won the Heisman Trophy. I said, he's going to be the next Bum Steer, and we laughed about it.
Did you say that back when we talked?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you're very forward-looking.
It just seems like whenever you have somebody that young, that much thrust into the public eye and given so much adulation, and you're just asking for trouble. You know something's going to go wrong.
Which is part of the reason why, you know, what's interesting about the Johnny Football story right now is that public opinion has really shifted on this question of whether or not the NCAA's rules about amateurism are fair. First of all, if he is found guilty of having taken money and he's suspended, he could be suspended for 5 games. He could be suspended for the entire season. There's all sorts of different, you know, ways that punishment could come out. But the big question is, what will the public's response to that be? In the last, you know, handful of years, we've seen a lot of other cases like this where players were suspended or were investigated for these kinds of violations. And this case is notable for various reasons, I think. for the fact that the public's response to it so far has been much more skeptical about the justice of the NCAA's rules than ever before. You know, people are saying Manziel was worth $37 million to A&M in terms of his marketing value just for about 2 or 3 months around his Heisman Trophy last year. And yet he can't take $7,500 to sign his autograph. Or, you know, college football as a business is valued at about $1.2 billion a year for the various conferences and schools. And yet, you know, one of the biggest stars in the game might be ineligible to play because he took $7,500. So that's become much more of a real debate than it has been in the past. And people are saying that we should just give up these rules. We should start paying the players. We should figure out a way to compensate them. We should acknowledge that this is actually not really an amateur event anymore because of the money that's involved. And, you know, that kind of gets at your question, your initial question, is we take these kids, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22 years old, and we put them up on these pedestals. And it's not only the ones that win the Heisman that get put up on the pedestals. They all do. I mean, they're playing on, you know, national television on Saturday. And we pretend as if it's still an amateur sport. We pretend as if it's, you know, as if they're just kids. But everything around them is treating them as if they're adults and as if they can handle that adult pressure.
That's the argument that Frank DeFord has been giving for many, many years.
That's right.
And but these are the rules that exist today, and these are the rules that we are supposed to be playing by. And Texas is a state where we're supposed, you know, we worship the rules and hierarchy and structure and authority. And it just seems to me that I'm seeing so many people doing moral gymnastics to give Johnny Manziel a pass.
Well, I mean, first of all, there is no proof that right now that he did anything wrong. I mean, him signing autographs is not itself illegal. Him signing autographs is not a violation of the rules. Him taking money for signing autographs is. And so far, there has not been proof that he did take that money. I'm not trying to use a technicality there. I'm just trying to state the facts. But I would actually back up and take.
I want to address that for a second. We know that he was signing bulk autographs, hundreds at a time.
Right.
And we're supposed to assume that he was doing that for free.
Well, we know that he did some of that stuff for, you know, charities would approach him and say, hey, we want you to sign a bunch of stuff for military.
But we know that there were autograph vendors or brokers, whatever you call these guys, that were dealing with him.
Right.
And Johnny knows that when he signs something, he's creating value.
Right.
And so he's going to do this in bulk for these guys who are going to make a lot of money off of him signing footballs and jerseys and whatever knickknacks from A&M. And he's just going to sit down and do it for nothing.
You know what? I don't know. I mean, sure. It's like what I'm saying is that we don't really know exactly what happened yet. And everybody's jumping to conclusions on both sides of the ledger. You know, whether he's guilty or whether he's innocent or whether it's a witch hunt or, you know, whether ESPN is out to get the A&M.
Is that what people say, that ESPN's out to get A&M?
Oh, yeah. At A&M, that's what some people are saying. It's one of the sort of funny developments of this whole case is that because of ESPN's affiliation, you know, loose affiliation with the University of Texas because of the Longhorn Network, there's conspiracy theories at College Station that ESPN is trying to destroy Manziel.
See, when you have that kind of tortured logic, you know that you're on shaky grounds.
Well, I'm talking about the most diehard Aggie fans on message boards. I'm not talking about, you know, the administration.
Sure.
But I think I would back up and take issue with the idea that, you know, in Texas we worship the rules. I mean, I think there's just as strong a kind of attraction to maverick characters who break the rules and who bend the rules and who work outside the law. And that's why I think, you know, you have people who are willing to, I don't know if shrug is the right word, but who are willing to, you know, accept Manziel despite the fact that he, you know, he's clearly not a paragon of virtue. I mean, even before this autograph stuff, you know, he's not the kid that's going to, yes, sir. Yeah, you know, yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. I'm just going to, you know, I'm happy to play football and I'm going to just sort of go to bed at 9 every night. I mean, he's the opposite of that. But I think that's people like that about him. You know, I mean, people, he's, and this is kind of what we were getting at with the way we put him on the cover and the way we wrote about him. He's on the cover as Superman. He's on the cover as a superhero who's blasting off.
And when he has that fist forward as he's charging into the sky, you should have put a Sharpie in that fist.
Well, you know, what's funny is that the cover has been Photoshopped heavily just in the last 2 days. So we've seen people have taken it and put a Sharpie in his hand. People have taken it and put, a fistful of dollars in his hand. One of the funny ones was somebody put a new hand on him so that he was doing the hook 'em horn sign. Because Manziel famously...
Now, that is out of control.
Well, he wanted to play for UT, which is something that UT fans never tire of rubbing in the faces of Aggies, that that Manziel, you know, as a child, his desired school was UT, and they didn't want him. So, you know, people have been messing around with the cover in that way. And that's, you know, I mean, that's kind of what we hope for, people to react to covers that way.
And the conversation we're having is the conversations that's happening in bars and office around the water cooler all across Texas.
All across the country. And honestly, I mean, Manziel has even kind of jumped the bounds of college football fans, and I think is sort of rapidly becoming somebody who people outside of college football know about and have an opinion about and want to talk about. And in some sense, you know, I mean, some of that is not even by his own design or effort. I mean, he just sort of has this, whether you love him or hate him, he has he's sort of a magnetic character in pop culture.
Jake Silverstein is the editor of Texas Monthly. The new issue has a cover story about the incredible rise and possible fall of Heisman winner Johnny Manziel, the quarterback for Texas A&M. Texas is the deadliest state for construction workers, and Texas is the only state that does not require building contractors to provide workers' compensation to cover the hospital bills when a worker gets injured on the job. And Texas is one of the biggest states when it comes to wage theft for construction workers. That's when on payday, the boss tells the contract workers to get lost. He ain't paying. It used to be that unions could be the solution for problems like this, but now organizations like the Workers Defense Project is coming forward looking for creative ways to protect the rights of the documented and undocumented workers. Christina Sinsoon is the director of the Workers Defense Project.
More workers die in Texas than in any other state. Up until a few years ago, it was when it reached its all-time peak, there was 142 workers that died in 1 year. That meant that every 2.5 days, a worker died in Texas. So while we've been talking about the economic miracle that Texas has been going through, it's clear that not everyone's benefiting at the same level.
I'm sure that there are many workers who they break an arm or something happens to them, lose fingers, and they're out of work for a while and they have no income.
Right. So the industry in Texas is almost a wild west in that there's so little regulation and so many injuries. So a recent study we did with the University of Texas showed that 1 in 5 construction workers in the state of Texas have been seriously injured on the job, requiring them to seek medical attention. And we're the only state in the country that doesn't require employers to carry workers' compensation coverage to pay for the medical care, the medical costs of a worker if they're injured. And that means that oftentimes taxpayers get stuck with the bill. So employers aren't just shifting the burden onto workers unfairly, but they're also shifting it unfairly onto Texas taxpayers. And so we're trying to change that in the state.
Well, with the Affordable Care Act coming online, does that provide some protection?
The Affordable Care Act will provide some protection for workers. But again, it's not a substitute for workers' compensation for when workers are injured so that they don't have to pay a portion of their medical bills. And also, we know that a full half of the workforce in the construction industry is undocumented. And so the Affordable Care Act will not cover them.
So tell me about the 21 Rio accident. What happened and what happened after?
The year we released our first construction study in 2009, where it showed that 142 workers had died. That same week, 3 workers were also killed on the job after they fell 11 stories from a faulty scaffold. Since then, in this city of Austin, we've gotten city council to really take note and interest in what's happening in safety for workers. So Austin is the only city in the state of Texas where workers are guaranteed rest breaks. you know, and where workers are required to have safety training on public works projects or projects with the city. And now Austin has more workers receiving rest breaks and have more workers that have safety training than in any other major city in Texas. So what we want to do is take those really groundbreaking initiatives, even though they're just basic rights, but they're groundbreaking for Texas, and start implementing and passing similar policies in cities like Houston and in Dallas and San Antonio, where there are hundreds of thousands of workers that don't even have these basic rights and coverage.
There is a system here where we have a big business, and then they have a contractor, and then a subcontractor, and then that subcontractor may find out another subcontractor, and they're the ones that go out and hire the undocumented workers and don't have any insurance or do workman's comp, so that the owner, the big corporate owner who's at the top of the chain, is insulated from all of this, but basically this system is set up to protect that person or company.
Right. You know, I remember talking to one large contractor and said the practice of subcontracting is the transfer of risk, that that is its sole purpose. It's us transferring the risk of everything that's happening in the industry that's illegal or would go against common industry practice for established businesses.
Is it transferring the risk or transferring the responsibility?
It's transferring risk and responsibility. And that's the way the construction industry is set up. And you see that more and more different parts of our economy are starting to use subcontracting. Walmart, for instance, is now using subcontracting to temp out, to bring in temporary workers to work in their facilities and not bring them on as employees. So it's happening in even big box stores. And all this means is that workers' rights, that workers have their rights stripped of them, and means that they get paid less and they have less benefits.
Are you making progress? Are you seeing successes? Are you going to change things in Texas?
I think we are going to change things, and I think we are changing things. I think the work that our organization is doing, representing really modest people that are asking for basic protections. I mean, these are folks that are asking for rest breaks, to have the right to drink water on the job, and if they're injured, have health care coverage. These demands are just so basic that you would think that they would just be able to pass, and people would see that it's just common sense practice to give workers these kinds of protections.
Christina Sensoon is the director of the Workers' Defense Project, which seeks to protect the rights of workers in Texas, the deadliest state in the nation for construction workers. On Sunday, Texas will recognize the bicentennial of the Battle of Medina, the failed attempt to liberate Texas and the bloodiest battle in the state's history. The precise site of the battlefield has been lost to time, but Texas historian Dan Arellano is determined to make sure that future Texans will remember the Battle of Medina.
Well, you heard that saying, if it happens in Vegas, it stays in Vegas. Well, if it happens in Texas, it's Texas history. And the Battle of Medina was the biggest, bloodiest battle ever fought in Texas, well, west of the Mississippi, for that matter. And, of course, this is the 200th anniversary. And the government of Texas, for the first time, has acknowledged that there was a first constitutional government of Texas that was founded on April 6th of 1813. So not only is it the 200th anniversary of the battle, it's the 200th anniversary of the founding of the first constitutional government of Texas.
Now, this is way before the Alamo and San Jacinto.
23 years.
So this is a major event of Texans, Tejanos, fighting Spanish forces for independence.
It was this area, of course, was called Nueva España, New Spain. And quite frankly, it had nothing to do with New England or the American Revolution. This was part of the Mexican War of Independence. And this was what the Tejanos contributed to the freedom of Mexico.
And it was a slaughter.
It was a tremendous slaughter. It was so disastrous that one-third of the Tejano community would be dead. One-third would flee to Louisiana. and the remaining third would live in terror.
Talk about the battle. Where did it happen? What were the forces that collided?
The Spanish forces had 1,830 combatants. That doesn't include the followers, the mule drivers, and none of that. That was combatants. The Tejanos, or they were the Republican Army of the North, as they called themselves, consisted of about 1,400, 900 Tejanos, 300 Americans, and perhaps as many as 200 indigenous, primarily Lipan, Mission Indians, and so forth. So it wasn't too overly matched. It's just that they encountered a superior, well-trained, disciplined army. The Republican Army of the North was a ragtag army of volunteers, Mexican Army deserters, and, of course, Tejanos.
And what kind of armaments did they have?
Well, the Republicans brought some. They had some superior weapons, but they were not adequate enough to fight a superior force. But since the early 1700s, the Tejanos and, of course, the Comanches and the Apaches had been trading with the British and the French for French and British armaments. So the Tejanos were doing the same thing. So they had good armaments, except they fell into a trap. As the army, the Republican Army of the North, was advancing, they were encircled in a trap, and 400 to 500 fell dead immediately. But the thing is that the battle lasted almost 3.5 hours, going one way or the other. And the battle happened 20 miles south of San Antonio, close to a community called Losoya, Texas.
The exact location, a mystery today.
It's still a mystery. Even though I have led 11 archaeological digs trying to find it. Now, I do know that a professor at Palo Alto College, maybe 10, 15 years ago, had a student come into his office, his history class, with a bucket full of grape shot, cannonballs. Somebody knows where it's at, except they're not talking. They're afraid that something could happen to their property. And after 11 years of searching, I more or less have given up. But see, the battle lasted so long that we feel that there were as many as 10,000 muskets fired and 900 cannonballs. The Army of Arredondo was ordered to pick up whatever was useful and not to leave anything there. But it would have been impossible for them to pick up all of those, all the weapons and the discarded arms that were left on the battlefield.
So somewhere south of San Antonio, there's a treasure trove.
Yes, sir. And if we ever find it, of course, it's too hot now to go digging. But in the fall, we probably will resume searching again.
Dan Arellano is an author and a Texas historian. He is organizing the Battle of Medina Remembrance and Recreation. Sunday, August 18th, is the 200th commemoration of the Bloody Battle. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Send your emails about the program to texasmatters@tpr.org. Or you can comment directly on our website at tpr.org. That's also where we have past Texas Matters programs to listen to. And we are available for free on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.